Welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we bridge learning gaps and empower families to access the special education services they need. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I'm thrilled to kick off season 3 with you. Our podcast is your go-to resource for special education, offering expert insights, inspiring stories, and actionable tips to help your child thrive. In this season, we'll dive deeper into the world of special education. So whether you're a parent, educator, or passionate advocate, join us in this journey. To make this season unforgettable, please like, listen, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more families and create a stronger, more inclusive future. So hit that subscribe button, join our community, and let's make season 3 a game changer. Thanks to listeners like you. Welcome, Destiny. I'm excited for us to talk because you are a parent turned advocate. And on our show, often it's professionals that are in just the professional world, but haven't had to be kind of guided there by their own personal journey and story. And I guess everybody is guided to their profession by their personal journey and story, but I'm excited to see how you became the advocate that you are. So welcome to the show and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
So again, my name is Destiny Huff and I'm actually a licensed professional counselor. So I've been in the mental health field for over a decade. That's where my initial passion started in working with children still. And so I've been in the school settings, in the classrooms with the younger kids in development centers. Now I'm currently in a private practice that I own. And so about a year ago or almost 2 years ago now, my oldest son was diagnosed with autism. And so we had seen little things here or there, and we just kind of thought that there's some perfectionistic tendencies, definitely some anxiety, because again, I'm a mental health professional, but we didn't quite know the extent until he got in the school setting. And then that's when there was a lot of behaviors and just a lack of support, not on the teacher side. His teacher was phenomenal and was working with us. She just didn't have a lot of support from the administration, unfortunately. So it was kind of like her and us like trying to support him. And so we got a psychologist involved, got an official diagnosis, and that led to me becoming an advocate. I'm also a military spouse. My husband's been in the Army for almost 10 years. And so I realized that this is going to be an ongoing journey as we relocate from one state to another. And so I decided to become an advocate for that reason, to help other families, not just military families, but other families that may have this struggle.
And it's so interesting, that experience as a military family. I had recorded earlier with Megan, who is a military spouse, and she focuses on advocacy work, supporting families that are military families and having to deal with transitioning with an IEP and learning, you know we have the federal law, but each state does it a little bit different and the paperwork looks different. And so that's certainly an added layer for you and your journey as well.
Yes.
And so can you tell us about what it can feel like for parents to discover their child has a special need or disability?
I think initially it's very much a shock. I will definitely say, even being a mental health professional, my first thought was, okay, he's got some anxiety. He's got some perfectionistic tendencies. So maybe he's got some OCD. But that was kind of what I was leaning to, because he would be, you know, and we don't use this term anymore, what they consider high functioning, quote unquote, right? And we know it's a spectrum, and so we shouldn't measure it that way. And so it wasn't until we completed an assessment for his psychologist that we were like, oh, yes, he does. And I knew how to score the assessment, being a mental health professional. And so I was like, oh, yeah, he's autistic. And so it was a bit of a shock and an adjustment. And I know that my husband, he like went straight to reading. He was really great about that. Like he was like, he wanted to understand because he didn't. He was like, I don't see it, you know, and that what we traditionally think of it being like. And so I think that was more so was getting past the thought of what we traditionally have learned it could look like or what it could be like, and accepting that, and then really accepting I will say, as someone that kept being told he is very high functioning, that I don't even like that word. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. They're like, well, your child seems to have this, this, and this. Well, because he's considered that until he's not. And then when he's struggling, everyone's confused as to why. And then they forget that he's autistic. So I don't like that term because I feel like it implies something. And they don't know the struggles and how hard he's working to portray like everything is okay.
I think that needs to be highlighted because you're absolutely right. As a parent, you see your baby in a very different light. And there are some folks in the world that get your baby and some folks in the world that may not. And we know that our babies at school are, and I say babies, and I don't mean this like teen tiny babies. They're always going to be my babies, even though, I mean, eventually they're going to not want to be babies, but so I mean, all age. So our kiddos are ones at home. And so, you know, we know that they are putting in so much energy and effort and time to look like their peers. And sometimes it's really hard because you know that they're really working five times harder sometimes than their peers in their classroom. So how do we frame this in a positive light for parents? Because it's, you know, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon when it is your kiddo and you're navigating being a parent and you're navigating the support that your child needs.
I think the biggest thing is knowing that there's so much support out there. I think you never know with like any community, I feel, you never know how much support there is until you become a part of that community. And working in the mental health field, I have worked with autistic kiddos before. And I never looked at it at the parent side, of course, just the professional side of like, I would look up resources on like how to support them, how to support the teachers working with them, how to support the caregivers. And little did I know that like I would be using those same resources to support, you know, to help other professionals support my son. And so I had to switch off the professional side of my brain and go into the parent side and say, okay, what support is for parents? And then that's when I found all of these resources. There's pretty much a local support group everywhere you go from what I've seen. And then there's military organizations that are specifically geared towards special education families affiliated with the military. And I never knew that because that was not something that applied to me specifically. And so seeing that, I was like, that's amazing.
Where would you, if I was a parent and I'm just learning a new diagnosis, where do you tend to point parents for their starting point in terms of whether they need resources or support groups? Where do you kind of say, all right, I want you to start here?
So
is there even here to start, I guess every situation is so different, right?
So the biggest thing I say is if they are receiving a diagnosis, so typically, you know, it'll come from a medical professional or a psychologist or a psychiatrist in that aspect, then getting your child in therapy services, requesting support groups from the provider, typically they have some. If you're a military affiliated family and say your child is diagnosed with autism, so you, because they are military, they will be in there, will end up on an IEP typically because of the said diagnosis. So autism, ADHD, they will be enrolled in what's called EFMP, which is Exceptional Family Member Program. What comes with that is a coordinator for medical, and then you have a family support coordinator. And so the family support coordinator is there for the educational piece. They can provide you with education on autism, ADHD, social skills, things like that. And then you'll have a specifically in for autism, you get a case manager and they check in with you. And what they do is they provide you a list of whatever you're requesting. And so for my son, I wanted a psychologist or therapist. And so they're like, do you need a psychologist or therapist? Do you need ABA? Do you need a psychiatrist? Because is your child on medication and you need to manage that? And there's a different case manager, but there's one for every duty station you go to. Okay. So they have regions. But I always direct to a mental health professional. I always say reach out to a mental health professional to get a better understanding of the diagnosis, to get a better understanding of what this process is going to look like. You know, the internet has all types of information, and you just want to make sure that it's accurate and recent. I went to a page the other day, and I made a post about this on my Instagram, where they're still talking about Asperger's. Like, it, you know, so it's like, that's not up to date. That's not a term that's used anymore. So, you know, I always caution with stuff like that. So I always say, go to a professional. And there are a lot of neurodivergent trained mental health professionals now. And that is their niche. And a lot of them are also neurodivergent. So they are, you know, just like any other population. So
I like how you direct people to a mental health person kind of first to get that overview of what to expect and kind of where to go, because, you know, outside of a school setting, that resources looks different than it does inside. But before we get into that, how do parents manage their feelings? Do you have any tips for this, their feelings and support their child at the same time? So how can they do both?
So I'm a big advocate of take a break. And I know that seems hard. And I have a lot of clients that are like, well, I can't. No, I'm not talking about, you know, a 2 hour time away from you, because it's not possible all the time. And most of the time, I'm talking about, it's okay to go in your bathroom for 5 minutes, take deep breaths and step back out. It's okay to rely on your supports, like your friends. You know, if you have a friend that is willing to watch them or to give you a few moments, or it, when my son was younger, of course, it was just, that was baby mom time. So it wasn't like, you know, like any other concerns at the time. My cousin used to come over and she would literally sit with him so I could just go shower. Like, things like that matter. So take that self-care time. If you have a spouse, talk to them. Tell them what you're dealing with. A lot of families, I've noticed a lot of the time when they're dealing with the diagnosis and the child heads into school, a lot of times mom is the go-to. Mom's getting called for behaviors. Mom's getting called for struggles. Mom's getting called because they forgot this. Mom's getting asked for solutions. And that's just overwhelming and exhausting. And sometimes you have to put a pause on it. And I know there was one time when my husband was off and I just told him, like, for the next 2 weeks, I need you to take the school calls. And that's when we were in the thick of it. And he took them. And I was like, because I need the mental break from my phone rings, my watch vibrates, and I'm checking it to see what it is. So do the self-care. Take the 5 minutes, lean on your support, communicate with others.
That is excellent. It really is, because when you're in that place of fear, it's hard to, you know, sometimes have actionable steps to take. So I love that you said that. And that communication piece is really key. There was this comedian, or I don't know where I saw it, maybe it was on like social media, but it was like, it was a man. And he said, at what point, he said, the phone rang and they wanted to know what bus my child rode on or something like that. I'm sure I'm getting it wrong. And the guy was like, at what point would you call the dad? What point would you call the dad? But you're not, I mean, we have so many excellent parents and I'm not trying to put anybody down, but you're right. Oftentimes the mom takes those first phone calls, and so, or series of phone calls, and, you know, and going into appointments. And so having that balance where, you know, maybe there's some appointments that dad goes to or mom goes to, or, you know, some sort of balance. If you're in a dual family home, you know, or if you're a single parent and you have this, reaching out to other folks to say, can you come and, you know, be that voice, or be that, you know, just sit next to me during the IEP or something to give you some strength, for sure.
Yeah. I always say, because I have this term I use called temporary single parenting. And that's what a lot of military spouses do. They're temporary single parents because their significant other has gone to the field or gone to school or deployed. And that's when I lean on my family the most, is after I had my son, my youngest son. I was taking my oldest to daycare and had my youngest son, and my oldest was only 2 at the time. And my sister came up and she went with me to like hold the baby while I went and did our registration because my husband was deployed. And then when he was deployed another time when I was pregnant with my youngest and I had my oldest, who again was less than two, my best friend would come and she would scoop him up and just be like, just rest. Or, you know, it's like, and that's why I say it's temp, because we know it's temporary, you know, most of the time they're coming back. But yeah, there's finding that support, finding at least that one person that understands that you need support and lets you lean on them, even if it's just a vent. And I think that's an important thing too. It's okay to say, I love my kid, but I'm exhausted.
Amen. Amen. It's just human, right? And it is human. And to just say to your friend, you know, hey, do you have a second? I really just need to get this out into the universe. And that is what good friends and family are for sure. So do you have anything specific, right? So if my child is not quite yet in school, what is out there to connect families to diagnosis tools at an early stage? What kind of support is there?
So there's a website called parentcenterhub.org. And it has early intervention services. So there's early intervention services available for 0 to 3, and then from 3 to 5. This is theoretically before they get to school, because most kids turn 5 before they actually start kindergarten. And these services are specifically for babies and young children that can have developmental delays and disabilities. And you do not have to have a medical professional's referral to seek these services out. And I think that's a lot of times where parents struggle, because they think, I need for a medical professional to say that there is a concern, right? No, you can say, hey, I keep my child at home every day. They don't go to daycare. And I'm seeing this and I feel like they're not on track with their development. And then you can seek out these early intervention services. And so every state has an early intervention program. And if you go to that website, it actually lists the states and it will direct you to the person that is coordinating the programs in your state.
How important is it to have a timely diagnosis?
I think it is very important, because I think it decreases your stress, if nothing else, but it also allows you to get interventions and supports in place early. So with our son, again, so when you talk about autism, it can be diagnosed as early as 10 months. And typically most kids with autism, quote unquote, are diagnosed by the time they're 2, right? Our son was diagnosed with autism when he was 5, and he checked all of the developmental boxes, quote unquote, right? And so, and I say that because, again, once we did the paperwork that we got specifically for autism, we were like, oh, he's autistic. His teacher did the paperwork for the autism during the evaluation. Oh, he's autistic. But that never crossed our mind, because he walked, he crawled. We just always thought he has a big vocabulary, like, you know, but when we look back at certain things, we're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Certain responses, certain reactions, restrictive emotion at times, you know, just certain things. But I always tell parents not to be hard on themselves, because even as a mental health professional, I did not see it, because that's not my area. And so I think it's just important for your stress, your peace of mind, and just to get the supports available in place. Because I think once your child is diagnosed, you want an immediate turnaround, right? And at one point I was so frustrated, and my husband goes, we got his diagnosis 6 months ago. Like, take a breath. He's like, and it felt, because of what you've been dealing with, right? Before the diagnosis, yeah, it felt like forever. Like, I was like, no, we've been dealing with this for over a year. And he's like, yes, we have, but we didn't know until 6 months ago. So now we're learning all the tools and supports and getting them in place. And now he's thriving. So
what if a parent disagrees with a diagnosis, or they feel like they want more testing?
So if they've already received, let's say, a special education evaluation in the school setting, then a parent can always get an independent educational evaluation, which is essentially what I call a second opinion. And they can say that they, you know, they disagree with the assessments, the diagnosis, basically just what the evaluation is saying. I always say that, you know, look at why you're disagreeing. You know, are you disagreeing because this is something that's difficult to accept? Or are you disagreeing because you genuinely are not seeing the things that they're reporting? And then also look at the fact that home and school are two different settings. And so I think oftentimes we don't reverse our views in the sense of a parent will say, I don't see that at home. And then the school will say, we don't see that at school, but nobody looks at the other side and goes, so that means both can be true.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it is true. And so if I'm a parent, I have a diagnosis. It doesn't always mean a diagnosis doesn't always mean that you'll receive or qualify for specialized instruction within a public school setting. However, you know, if there's an educational impact and you qualify under the 13 categories in IDEA, and that your child does receive that specialized instruction and IEP and individualized education plan, how do parents get that crash course on an IEP? Because so we've talked about this, the feelings of, you know, okay, I hear that my child has a diagnosis. This kind of opens the door for services and support. It can be super overwhelming. And then now I've got to go into the school and advocate for my child so that they can get support to access their education. So how do parents kind of get that crash course?
So I feel like...
Or should we avoid the crash course? How do we do that?
I feel like the crash courses are necessary, okay? Because I think you need to have just a general understanding of like, what is an IEP? And a lot of times when we talk about crash courses, that's the biggest thing I see. Like they can go through, you know, a brief training on like, what is an IEP? What is having an IEP mean? But I also think that it is going to be a learning process. As your child goes from kindergarten to fifth grade, to eighth grade, to senior year, it's always going to be different. Even if you stay in the same school district, your child's entire educational career, there, as they grow and develop, their diagnosis and their needs are going to change and adjust. Things that were issues before are no longer going to be concerns. Things that weren't concerns are going to become concerns. But thankfully, we have had a shift where there's been a lot of trainings in the past few years. So I always say, seek out an advocate. They can help educate you on what an IEP is, what the process is. If you're referring specifically to military, you have school liaisons, you have the EFMP family support, you have what's called STOMP, and they provide specifically webinars on like IEPs, accommodations, modifications, understanding an IEP document, and those are free. And that, you know, and those are again geared towards our military families. For the civilian side, which is what we call the non-military families, seek out an advocate. I always say go to the education website, like specifically start learning what IDEA means. What are the components of IDEA? What does it cover? What is your child entitled to? Because what you're going to find is as you adjust, because we know the school system is struggling, they're trying to recover from COVID and issues that have bogged it for years. And they don't always have the tools to provide certain accommodations. And so that's when you have to advocate and fight for what you know your child needs to be successful. And the best way to do that is to understand IDEA.
100%. Understanding IDEA foundation, for sure. And then understanding, if I can add to that, how to collect data on your kid. Yes. And which all of this sounds overwhelming. So I hope parents are taking a deep breath. And at the end, you're going to tell everybody where to find you. And so just that guidance on how to take data, because as you said earlier, our babies, our children react or act one way sometimes in our home. And then sometimes it looks very different in the school. So being able to say, you know, that I'm, you know, requesting counseling service, and this is the data behind it. And this is why, because you can request counseling service in an IEP under IDEA. or this is what their homework time looks like and they're melting down, and this is why I need that support to kind of make you that equal. You are an equal player, but I think by coming with data, you are then really showing like, I know the law and I know my kid, and this is what I'm seeing, and this is why this service that I'm in, they're entitled to under the law, aligns with my request.
And requesting data from the school to add to what you're seeing. I know that what I did was, so first of all, you should be receiving a draft of an IEP before you step in that meeting. And I always say this, that benefits everybody, because when I get a draft, I am thorough. Like, I make sure I sit down, I have my pen, I'm going through what's adding up, what's not adding up, what does this look like? And then I send an email and I say, these are the questions I have, these are the comments I have, these are the concerns I have. What that allows is for the IEP team to say, okay, mom wanted this, this, and this. So my son had we changed his schedule and we changed his eligibility category. His last school did not classify him under autism, even though all of their documentation said it and he had the diagnosis. It was under social emotional developmental delay. And his new school did their due diligence, gathered their data, and they were like, we feel that his category should be autism. And me and dad were like, as did we. And that's what we were fighting as we were leaving to come to where we are now. And so, but I had said, hey, can I see the academic data? Because there's concerns about when he's out of the classroom, you know, due to being unsafe. And what happened? His general ed teacher had the school psychologist put it up there, and she ran through all of his classes, all of his subjects, all of his, where he's at, all of his testing. The school psychologist pulled up the behavior data and all the data they'd gathered to justify changing his schedule. And they ran through that with us. I mean, and that's what communication and collaboration can work towards. And so my thing was, it had been mentioned to us previously by someone that we might need to add academic goals in there because he's out of class or he's missing time due to behaviors. But then we look at the data and we collaborate with his special ed and his gen ed teachers, and we're all like, no, we're still on the same page. That's not necessary. So that's what data does for you. It takes that anxiety away and it gives you a leg to stand on in case adjustments were being made. The other side of that I do want to say is, remember that an IEP team has several members, right? So if you're just doing your catch-all, right, you say the administrator, which is simply a principal or assistant principal. For the ones I've had, a school psychologist, but I found that school psychologists don't always have to be on there, from what somebody told me of recently. And I was like, okay, learn something new. And then the gen ed teacher, and then either the special education teacher or they're called resource teacher. You know, they have different names, but they're typically part of the IEP team. And then of course the parents. But what I always tell parents is, it's important when, let's say, an administrator mentions something, that you're having communication and conversation with your child's gen ed teacher and special education teacher. Because you have to remember, the administrator is coming in from a, this is what I'm hearing today and addressing concerns. And the special education teacher and the general education teacher and the parent are usually the ones that are like, we know these concerns. So I just say to make sure there's that communication there. And if you have concerns, you're going back to that main source who you always communicate, which is typically going to be your general ed teacher and your special education teacher.
I love your collaborative approach, and it 100% needs to be that way. And, you know, most of the times it is, and sometimes it's not. You had mentioned the word advocate. What is the difference between a special education advocate and an IEP coach?
Okay. So an IEP coach, in my opinion, if that's just their title, you're talking about training on IEPs, helping someone learn the ins and outs of IEPs, learning about that process. And the main focus is the IEP itself, the document, the process, what goes into the document. And again, this is my opinion. An advocate is someone that is giving the parents the tools to advocate for the entire process. So I'm not just looking at your IEP. I'm looking at your behavior intervention plan. I'm looking at, you know, looking at those accommodations and modifications. I'm teaching you how to write a parent concern letter. I'm teaching you how to advocate for your child. Because as an advocate, we want you to get to a point where you feel comfortable not needing us. And so we're not just doing it for you. We are teaching you how to do it. So most advocates, where we start out at is you bring me your concerns and let me help you help your child. Then if we continue on and we see a need to like attend the meetings, or if you're already at that stage, then we do that. But our start is you write this parent concern letter. I'm going to teach you how. You write this parent input statement. I'm going to teach you how. Let me show you how to look through your behavior intervention plan. Let me show you what accommodations and modifications it appears based on the data that your child would benefit from. Let me show you how to request data. Like, we're doing all those things. And so when you add in being an IEP coach, then we also have that extra training of not just helping you advocate, but knowing the ins and outs of an IEP to help you through that process.
That is very interesting, your lens, because as you're saying that, I do all those things, right? But my background is in special education. So I'm very comfortable with sitting at the IEP table, writing the behavior intervention plans, doing the IEPs and doing that. And so I do that with my parents, but I really lean on that word IEP coach, because when it gets contentious, I'm not your girl. And I'll say that to families. I'm like, I'm going to get you to the point. We're going to write your parent, you know, input statement and everything you just described. And I was like, but as soon as it gets contentious, I say this up front. I was like, I have people to refer you to. So I think that's where my divide is. And I think we all have our comfort, but so I love that. But I think it's important for parents to have somebody or some resource that can guide them with all of this information, because it's overwhelming. And again, if it is your child, you're in the thick of it. So to have the neutral party to kind of guide you in that. And then eventually, you know, even with our students that we work with and support, we want to teach them the skills and strategies to eventually independently employ in the classroom or outside. So I guess that's kind of my lens with parents as well. And that's what I hear from you. Can you give parents an overview of that timeline? Because, and you had mentioned it as well, you know, with when you first got your diagnosis and then you're to your husband, like, oh my gosh, it's already been 6 months. Come on, the time's ticking. But it takes a little bit, right? So if your child is going to qualify, and I teach a course on this for eligibility evaluation, all of that, what does that look like for a parent so that they can really understand that this process, I'm not getting a diagnosis yesterday and going into the school and getting an IEP today?
Right. So the first thing is they have 60 days, and 60 days can feel like a lifetime, because my experience and what I've seen other parents go through is usually you have behaviors, you have concerns, and then it's like, oh, let's do some type of behavior plan and see if that's effective after we've tried these strategies and tools. Then that doesn't seem effective. So then it's like, let's look at a special education evaluation. And then for most parents, if you're like I was, I thought, okay, we're getting a solution. We're getting an answer. Like, let's go. No, because most schools, and I always say, you have to remember your child's not the only child, but I also say my child is the one who matters to me. But they have that timeline. And so during that timeline, your child is typically being observed, they're doing observations, they're doing assessment tools with your child, depending on what they're trying to assess for. With my son, they were looking at speech, they're looking at social emotional, they're looking at social skills, his interactions with peers, emotional regulation. And so they're doing these observations, they're gathering data, your general ed teacher is filling out assessments, parents are being sent home to assessments to fill out. We had a social worker who called and got background information on our son, and she was kind of like the last linchpin for us through that process, because they had done all the assessments and everything. But most schools are going to take that time, because again, whether you would say short-staffed or just a lot of children, but What I have seen is when you're talking about that initial special education evaluation, this may not be every parent's experience, and I'm sure it's not. They do stay within that lens because of that federal law and what that means to not. Now, once that time, during that time frame, though, always read your procedural safeguards that you are given when you sign for the special education evaluation, because the day that we signed for my son's evaluation, and again, he's in a different school now, different setting, great team, great communication, collaboration. Not then, the day I signed for the special education evaluation, he was suspended. And I, of course, don't have, you know, I don't have the capacity to like really have a conversation with you about that. Like I'm my kid just got suspended. I'm overwhelmed. This was not his first suspension. It was a lot. And then I talked to a friend of mine who is in special education, and she was like, she was like, say what now? So that's what I really realized. I don't know anything about this process, but they have that time frame. Read your procedural, your safety and procedural guards, and communicate with them, check in with them. You have that right. Do not feel like for 60 days you have to sit silent. Don't feel like you don't have anything to say. Do not feel like they can't implement techniques and tools to support him during the time they're collecting data. Do not, if you have suggestions, you see something working at home, tell them. If you're having issues at home, tell them. Communicate all that. For my military families, once your child receives an IEP, they need to be enrolled in EFMP, which again is Exceptional Family Member Program. And remember that, because we were about to PCS, which is a permanent change of station. So we were about to move to a new location, and we did not know that. So there's medical EFMP and there's educational. Educational is for IEPs, and medical is depending on the diagnosis and the impact and the services they will need. Autism always falls in that category. And so we had to enroll, medical takes longer than educational. So we had to enroll him in both, and that delayed us moving. And so, because the school does not have to up their timeline just because you are relocating and need that IEP, and you can't enroll without the IEP.
There's a lot of acronyms.
Yeah.
Right. How can parents work on maintaining that positive point of view and a positive communication style? Because that really goes a long way, right?
It does. The first thing for me is when you are collaborating with your IEP team, when you're meeting with your IEP team, find out how the IEP team members communicate. What is their source of communication? And now I always say email for that official communication. When I sent my parent concern letter, when I sent my initial parent input statement, that was email, you know, all IEP team members on the email. But for general things like our son has night terrors. And so sleep plays a big part in his day. And so we communicate that to the general education teacher and his special education teacher. And so in the morning, I'll get up, I'll say, hey, good morning. He had 3 night terrors last night, but he seems to be in a good mood this morning and functioning and doing fine. And they're like, thank you for letting me know. We'll keep that in mind. What does that mean is that if normally he gets 3 breaks in his day, now he might get 5. Because we already know that sleep is a basic need and he did not get all of his sleep. And so that is so very important. And so, but as far as the types of communication for his general education teacher, she uses the Remind app. So I Remind app her whatever comments or statements, you know, outside of like the sleep ones or ones we discuss, go in email to both, because that goes into his file. Because then we know like, oh, he had this rough day, but we know it's correlated with his sleep, which is being addressed by his primary care doctor. And then for his special education teacher, she's email. So anything I need to communicate with her, I send to email. And then when I communicate with the whole team, it's via email, but find out how they want to communicate. We set up a thing where my son said that he likes when they call me and tell me when he's had a great day, like that's how he feels rewarded, you know, and comforted. And he's like, that's it. Like they asked him and like, he could have picked anything. Like, I want ice cream. And he was like, I just want you to call my mom and tell her I had a great day. And so they'll do that. They'll have him there. And sometimes he'll speak to me. Sometimes he won't. And they're like, he's just smiling here, mom. but they call me to let me know that he had a great day. So, but find out how each member wants to communicate and then how you're comfortable communicating. I'm comfortable communicating via email because I always say documentation. And in the mental health field, you learn if you didn't write it, it didn't happen. So I always love that. So that when it's like, oh, we didn't get this, or you didn't send this, or you didn't see this, I go right back in my email and I can forward you the original documentation.
On this date, at this time. Can parents champion staff to be invested in their child's IEP?
Oh, definitely.
What does that look like?
I think you have to, and this is both sides, parents to staff, staff to parents. Both sides have to show that they are genuinely invested in this child's success. And the way that you can do that is through communication and showing understanding when questions are brought up. So for me, a big moment was when I asked about my child's behavior because there was something written down on his paper. And I just messaged his general ed teacher in the resources in the Remind app. And I was just like, hey, could you give me a little more explanation on this? I'm not entirely sure. And she did a rundown and I said, well, I'm a little concerned because this behavior has been ramping up. And we ended up having what we called a collaboration and communication meeting with me, her, and the special education teacher, like a week later. And I said, I'm a little concerned. And she said, you know what? I'm concerned too. She was like, he was doing really well. And she's like, I'm not sure what's going on either. He's like, usually I can get him redirected and he complete his work. But she was communicating and dialoguing with me. And that made me feel like, okay, you care. You're not just like, yeah, he did this. What are you going to do about it? And so I think, but at the same time, she had mentioned him struggling. So because of his kindergarten struggles, he was not on grade level for reading. And we knew this, and it was due to his suspension. So when they did all their data collection, as you should, that's where we found that out, and we were not surprised at all. So she gave us things to work on, and we did. And then I would say, hey, Miss Such and Such, I noticed he gets really frustrated at this part. She's like, yeah, we're working on that in class. She was like, I noticed that too. If he doesn't understand why the word does this, and it doesn't make sense to him, she's like, he kind of gets frustrated, he shuts down. So she saw that I'm implementing the things that she's suggesting as well. And then in the IEP meeting, I'm able to say, well, yes, we've used Ms. Such and Such's tools that she gave us. So she's saying, okay, you're collaborating, you're working with me. You're trying to address his behaviors. You know, he's having behaviors. So we're reading books on certain behaviors and how to manage your emotions and feelings, because that's a struggle for him. I'm telling them, hey, I'm using this book. I sent it in his book bag. Next thing I know, she's reading it to the whole class. The communication has to be there. Don't brush off what a parent says and don't brush off what a staff says. Respond to it. And if you don't understand, ask questions. And if you have a different insight, then bring that insight.
Absolutely. So what are some of the key advocacy points that you focus on with parents?
I focus on, what do you want for your child? That is a big one for me. I think that a lot of times, not that it gets left out, but I feel that parents are so overwhelmed with the process, they don't stop to think about that. You're presenting me all of these theoretical solutions that have worked for other children. And I'm so flooded that I can't even, I'm like, okay. But then I might get home and go like, my child does not like that though. That would not be a good reward for him. Or that might even be a trigger. So the first one is, what are your concerns and what do you want for your child? What are you concerned about in the educational setting? What are you concerned about them not doing or not getting? Are you concerned about inclusion? Are you concerned about them participating? Are you concerned about them having friends because of their struggle with social skills? Like, what are you concerned about? And what do you want to happen? You know, what do you want to see? What do you want them to accomplish? The next thing is communicating. I think that a lot of times parents are talked at and then they hold it in and they get so frustrated that then they start talking at staff and then nobody is collaborating. So, you know, ask questions. You confused? Ask a question. You don't understand? Ask a question. Ask for a resource. You feel like they're not understanding your child? Provide them with information. Provide them with what works. You know your child in the home setting, and some of the triggers are similar. So say, well, at home we do this. how can we do that in the class setting? And an example I always give is, my son can get upset and he can just go to another room in our house. He can't do that at school. That's elopement. So we talked about that. What can he do? Okay, this can be where he can go to take a break when he's upset. That way he is removing himself from the room, but it's not elopement, and this is where he can go. So that's how we collaborated on that, because they're like, you're not seeing this when he gets upset. No, because he can just go to another room. He doesn't have, like, so those are the big ones. It's just, what are your concerns? What do you want to see your child? How do you want to see your child grow? And then that communication.
Excellent. So for civilians, when their child, their student goes to a different grade level or a different school, even though, you know, what do you recommend for both? So military, it's different because they may be going to a different state or country. Uh-huh. But in essence, your child is being introduced to new staff uh-huh. as they transition. What do you recommend to parents to help them communicate with the school that this is my child, here's their gaps, here's their gains, this is what they look like, and then setting up that communication for success from day one?
Have the most recent IEP. So have that in your physical possession. Even if they're in the same school and they're going to the next grade, have your own physical copy. The next one is, I like having the teacher kind of, you know, if you can, kind of give a rundown of, like, you know, what the child was working on, what they've learned, just kind of giving an understanding from a teacher to teacher perspective. Of like, this is how great this child is, and these are all of his strengths, and these are some of his struggles that we were still working on, right? Because that applies to the classroom setting. So again, the first thing, have a physical copy of the IEP. The second thing is going to be, if you can get the teacher to just kind of write a summary about the child, and that's really beneficial if you're going to another school, to give that kind of understanding of what was working in the classroom from their teacher. And then I love the all about me's. That's the third thing. And that allows for the child to be able to have input into what do they want their teacher to know about them and to understand about them. And like my son always says, he's shy, and that's true. And so, you know, they'll know, like, he's kind of shy. It takes him a minute to warm up and get to know them. So that's the third thing. And then the fourth thing is reaching out to finding out who handles the special education at that school for that grade. For my son, he will switch special education teachers next year when he enters second grade, because his current one does kindergarten and first grade. And the next one in the school does, I think, second and third. And then I have one that does fourth and fifth. So I will be introducing myself to her, talking with her, seeing what her things are, what she does for her second graders. Use the open house. If you have an open house, to just be able to introduce yourself and to make sure that they're aware that your child's on their roster. Because sometimes, you know, they have a lot of students, they have a lot of kids, they handle multiple grades. Sometimes they don't know. I like to put a name to a face. This is my kid. I'm his mom. You will be hearing from me. How do you like to communicate? I look forward to seeing you at our initial IEP. So those are all the things that I would recommend.
In your opinion, what are the three key points of the IEP?
The three key points of the IEP are, first of all, the performance, the present levels of academic and functional performance, and it's called many things, PLAF, PLOP, PLEP. But that area is supposed to have your child's current levels of performance academically, functionally, behaviorally, what are their strengths, what are their challenges, their barriers, what are you trying to accomplish with this IEP? It encompasses a lot. And what I always say, and I actually just recently did a post on this, is that the only time that information should be the same is your initial IEP meeting when you're coming in for the new school year. So let's say your kindergartner is going into first grade. That information is going to be reflective from last year, because they haven't had the ability to collect data. They haven't started the assessments. You know, they haven't gotten into the nitty gritty of the school year. So that's the only time that information should really be the same. Once you get into your annual IEP meeting, or if you're requesting an IEP meeting to change category eligibility or because the schedule's not working, to add or remove accommodations, modifications, that should be different. And the reason why is because that present level is based on data. So at this point, you should have data to say, okay, this is what we're seeing, this is what we're not seeing, okay? So the present levels, the annual goals, it's very important. What is your child working on? And why do they feel you need, your child needs to work on it? And do you feel your child needs to work on it? And where's the data to support it? So that's a big one. I noticed that a lot of parents don't know what their children are working on because, again, it's overwhelming. So they're just like, well, they're doing really good. On what? And that matters because when they're not doing really good, then you can say, okay, can I see the data? Well, they were doing here, good here. Now they're not. What was happening during this time? Or is this a trend? Is this something we need to be concerned about? Do we need to adjust the goals? Okay. Also, I'm a big proponent of breaking them down, making them specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely in the sense of, is this something accomplishable? Because I want my child to feel successful. And we also should not be having the same goal for 5 years, because then that means something we're doing is not working. And the last part that I did identify as part of the IEP that I think is important is the Gen Ed accommodations and modifications and assessment modifications. So that section, when you go into the IEP, this is looking at what accommodations and modifications are being made to allow for your child to be successful in the general education setting, what accommodations and modifications are being made when they do assessments, you know, and making sure that is stated and making sure what subjects it applies to. Because, and again, a lot of IEPs are different, a lot of places are different, but make sure that you're looking at that, because I thought my child was getting a break for his testing. And at his last school, we discussed it. We were told he was going to get pulled. I'm thinking that's what I'm reading in the IEP. Apparently it was not. So he had a meltdown that day during testing. And then I was notified and I said, I thought it was in his IEP. Isn't that what this means? Oh, that's not what that means. Oh, so those are the three areas. Again, the present level of academic achievement and functional performance, annual goals, and then the accommodations and modifications for general ed and assessment.
As we're winding down, is there anything that I did not ask that I should have asked?
No, I think you covered everything. I think I just want to reiterate that you do not have to do this alone. And so don't. Even if you just bring a friend to the meeting to take notes or to hold you accountable for questions you wanted to ask, lean on support. Because that's what's going to, this is a long process. Like I say, get started in kindergarten and you have many, many years to go.
Marathon, not a sprint. Yes. If you had, I think you kind of just answered this, but if you had a billboard with one quote for parents, what would it be and why?
Yeah, you're right. It would be, you don't have to do this alone.
I think that's amazing. Amazing. Where can folks find you?
So you can find me on my website, which is destinyhuffconsulting.com. You can find me on Facebook under the same thing, Destiny Huff Consulting. And I have a LinkedIn page, which is Destiny Huff Consulting. But the last one is a little different. So you can also find me on Instagram, and it's destinyhuff_IEP_app.
Thank you for your time. This was incredible. I hope parents have paper and they listen and they pause and they write notes and they truly feel that they don't have to do this alone, that this process that seems overwhelming, that you're coming from this fear and love, you can walk that journey with other folks that have walked it to kind of ease that stress and that burden for you. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Bye for now. Thank you again for tuning into another episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you found today's podcast insightful and valuable. Before we sign off, remember to show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to our podcast. Your engagement helps us continue our mission of empowering families and bridging learning gaps in special education. Don't forget to spread the word about the Special Ed Strategist podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who may benefit from our content. Together, we can make a difference in the lives of children with special needs. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I can't wait to bring you more inspiring content in the future. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep making a positive impact. Goodbye for now.